From beach towels to tea towels, and from mugs to water bottles, the TNT Shop has it all. Browse our shop now at TNTRadio.live. TNTRadio.live.
I just kind of stream it online.
Yeah, online.
Listen online every day.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, this is TNT Radio. I'm Nicola Charles. Now, I don't know about you, but I've learned a lot of things in the past 3 years I hadn't expected to. I learned, for instance, that Switzerland is far from neutral. They hold the World Economic Forum there. I learned that 500 years of human civilization and advancement can be destroyed without bombs or aliens. I'm also now reasonably convinced that the Russians do, in fact, love their children too. I now know that love is most definitely not all we need, and that I will never again say, God save the Queen, or in fact, say it for any monarch. Disappointingly, I know that doctor is not a more noble profession than lawyer, and that I wish forensic blood work could be undertaken by all politicians who had a hand during this period in history to ascertain if in fact they did inject mRNA as they advised others to do. I learned, surprisingly, that the fate of the greedy globalists could lie by the bedside of a Thai princess, believed to be vaccine injured and in a coma. And I learned that an app that kids use to make skating videos with could actually be a Chinese spy device. But hey, who needs Chinese spy devices when you have dictator Dan Andrews as your premier in Victoria, Australia? A lot of things we're seeing and hearing just don't make any sense anymore, or we've been told they are conspiracy theories, just long enough for evil globalists to enact their plans, before learning that those theories are now actually facts. No explanations or apologies are ever forthcoming. Instead, we're left to trawl the World Wide Web for truth. We get economic facts from the Treasury websites, almost as governments are denying the facts' existence. We get health facts from recipients of healthcare on the ground or in it, depending on how many injections they've had. And we get the truth about the plans our governments have for us via letters through the door, slipped in with piles of flyers for real estate agents and local puppies for sale. This week, residents in Victoria got one of these nasty shocks. Sorry. Truths in the mail from the government of Victoria, along with instructions on how they, innocent people, will be taking part in yet another government trial. I guess it's because the last one, the vaccine trial, went so well. It didn't come with ribbons or bows or even a giant floating balloon above Victoria. It came instead with a GPS device. The Victorian Integrated Study on Travel and Activity. Sounds innocent enough, doesn't it? But it's not. Because like everything else our governments have backed in the last 3 years, it works against the population, not for them. The Department of Transport would like you to take part in a survey. My advice is don't. What is being asked of non-criminal Victorians is essentially to wear a felony ankle bracelet on days asked to ascertain the extent of their movements. Though it looks more like a garage door opener, it's far more than that. While governments refuse transparency on the vaccine status of all Australians dying suddenly, they expect transparency from you about your daily movements, and they won't be seeking a warrant to get it. Also, in other news, after years of seeking answers as to what to do with people suffering PTSD, like millions, I assume, at this point, the brainiest brains in science have settled on prescribing MDMA. Yes, you heard that right. MDMA, the laboratory-created equivalent of an ecstasy tab, is now to be prescribed legally to sufferers of depression and PTSD. On Friday, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, known here as the TGA, announced that from the 1st of July 2023, the medical use of MDMA and psilocybin will be rescheduled from Schedule 9, prohibited substances, to Schedule 8, controlled medicines, of the poisons standard. This will enable authorized psychiatrists to prescribe these substances for patients suffering from treatment-resistant depression and treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder. How could we not have questions about all this? After all, during the Vietnam War, the Department of Defense provided soldiers between 1966 and 1969 with 225 million dextroamphetamine tablets, speed, while a third of all those serving were using a combination of heroin, opium, and marijuana. Then, in the Iraq War, the Department of Defense filled 50,000 prescriptions a month for narcotics for serving soldiers between 2003 and 2007. Does this data not prove that drugs in fact cause PTSD, not cure it? And here we go again with the Greens, always looking to validate their existence with pointless ideas. They want 16-year-olds to be able to vote. We'll be discussing this and a lot more after this quick break. This is TNT Radio.
The news you want.
They cover the important story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
Yeah, good, Nicola.
What do we have in the news today?
Okay, well, this is a big story. Anyone buying a gun in Western Australia will have to undergo mandatory ongoing mental health checks as part of a complete overhaul of the state's 50-year-old firearms legislation. So the changes are designed to create some of the toughest gun laws across Australia. And this law in Western Australia is independent of any potential national gun register. It will make Western Australia the first state or territory requiring specific, legislated, and recurring mental health checks for gun owners. Now, 20 people died from gunshot wounds in the state last year, and Police Minister Paul Papalia says mental health issues were involved in at least half of those deaths. And isn't it the only solution? It's not a guaranteed solution, he says, but it's more than what we do now. And we are obliged to do our best to make the community safer. The state government announced last March it would overhaul Western Australia's 1973 Firearms Act, and the new legislation is currently being drafted, and mental health checks will be one of those key features in the new laws. Under the policy, around 89,000 Western Australian residents who hold firearms licenses will have to undergo compulsory mental health screening. So, Nicola, I think some people will be happy about the legislation, but I think many won't.
Yeah, I think plenty of people on the left are going to be absolutely delighted with that. My concern is that differs from the American system a fair bit. See, in the American system, they check before selling you a weapon that you don't have a history of, I guess, being sectioned and mental health issues that are recorded. But here they're going to actually physically sit you down and do a mental assessment. I find that quite concerning. Do people tend to think this law is going to make us safer, Jeremy?
Well, obviously, some people do, particularly those on the so-called left-wing side of politics, and they always have pushed for more and more laws. But at the end of the day, some people do have mental health issues, no doubt about that, and they would be dangerous holding firearms. But then again, those same people would be dangerous in possession of a can of petrol or a knife or anything else. So I'm not too sure that it will make us safer.
And do we know that if people who already own firearms and legitimately have their license and have held it for a long time, are they going to be hauled in for this test, do we know, or is it just new licensing coming up?
I don't know for sure. I haven't studied the legislation, but I suspect that it would be the case that this would be an ongoing thing, because that was saying in the news reports that I've seen that it would be ongoing. So if that is the case, that's quite concerning. But people were really, I would say, find it quite humiliating to undergo a mental test on a regular basis when they know that they're perfectly sane mind. And we must remember psychiatrists get it wrong from time to time. Psychologists do.
They certainly do.
and I probably would have been deemed to be mentally unfit because I was saying I'm not really prepared to go along with this experimental injection. And no, yes. no, you're insane. No, you shouldn't be saying that would be the answer. Actually, some people, Nicola, who have suffered some horrific injuries from these experimental jabs have been told that they have mental illness because the doctors don't want to admit that they do have a real illness caused by some experimental mRNA jabs. So would the same apply to gun owners, Nicola?
Well, I see a future with some of these hilarious political cartoons that we see, Jeremy, where you've got sort of a farmer turning up on a tractor to have his mental health assessment because he needs a gun to keep his animals safe from predators. And, you know, he's lying on the couch and the psychiatrist or the psychologist is saying to him, "And are these foxes in the room with us now?" That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jeremy. That was a great report. I look forward to looking in that a bit more. We're just going to take a really quick break. You're listening to TNT Radio.
Politically incorrect on TNT Radio.
Just in the last week or so, I've noticed a lot of various governments or medical people or individuals recanting or making revelations about rather serious injuries. To me, it looks like there's a bit of a collapse in the whole lies that we've been told for 2 and a bit years, but I'd love to hear your observation of the chaos that might be starting to consume the Visigoths of hell that we're dealing with.
Yeah, well, they're good words, actually. Collapse and chaos. I'm shell-shocked by it all. I'm just like, what the heck? Because we've endured this for 3 years now, this awakening of our own governments are our enemy. I'm reeling from it. And I'm wondering when people are going to realise what's been done to us, and particularly the people who have been stuck with the needles without informed consent.
Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Action Against Hunger is the world's hunger specialist, with the highest 4-star rating from Charity Navigator, and 93% of every dollar donated going directly to our humanitarian programs. Active and on the ground since 1979, innovating, advocating, empowering, and saving lives in over 45 countries. Nearly 95% of our staff serve in their home countries, braving conflict and difficult terrain to help 20 million strong, resilient people overcome unthinkable circumstances. From South Sudan to Yemen, from Somalia to Bangladesh, Action Against Hunger gets to hard-to-reach communities, providing aid where others cannot. Our teams are on call 24 hours a day and ready to get life-saving help into the field. The need is acute. 16 million children suffer from the most severe form of hunger. 2 million a year lose the fight to deadly hunger. And more than 5,000 children still die every day from hunger-related causes. There's a need to scale up, and a need for individuals and partners to support innovative programs around the globe. With your help, Action Against Hunger can train and mobilize even more local field teams. With your help, we aim to double the number of children receiving treatment for life-threatening malnutrition. With your help, we can keep saving lives. The world needs a better way to deal with hunger. Together, we're creating it for everyone, for good. Join us. Take action against hunger.
Visit actionagainsthunger.org. A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
Don't forget and don't forgive. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
So non-criminal Australians, everyday people just like me, are being asked in the post if they're happy to be issued with a tracking device that looks like a garage door opener that is actually a GPS device by the government to have their movements tracked and traced perhaps, on days that the government would like it to be tracked. It's not mandatory, not yet. But to discuss this further, my first guest is Peter. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Nicola. How are you going?
Yes, I'm good. I'm just wondering how you're feeling about this, because I tell you what, if I get one of these in the post, it's going straight in the bin. How do you feel about it?
Well, I greatly oppose government overreach in terms of these sorts of things. But I haven't prepared for this particular discussion. I thought we were talking about housing affordability.
Ah, yes, I thought so too in the second hour. Oh, well, Peter, we can have a chat about this.
We can talk about this if you prefer. I haven't heard of this story, actually, because most people are quite happy. Most people are hanging on to their track and trace device for dear life. It's in their hands all the time, their mobile phone.
Yes, I know. But I do everything I can to switch mine off location and stuff unless I'm using Google Maps. I don't know about anyone listening. I really advise you do that.
I don't even use Google Maps.
Oh, well, you're very good, aren't you? Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we can go on and talk about housing affordability, absolutely, because it's devastating, the news that I think 800,000 Australians are going to come off their fixed rate mortgages. And I just don't know what that's going to do to them, because the interest rate hikes haven't stopped yet. What do you think the upshot of this is going to be? How are people going to cope, Peter?
Well, a lot of people aren't going to cope. I mean, this was intensely predictable years ago. They were pumping the property bubble up. Every policy the government put forward over recent years was designed to entice first home buyers into the market. So they were enticing them to buy overpriced houses. All sorts of benefits were given to them. You know, stamp duty exemptions and all sorts of programs were put in place specifically to keep the bubble going, because the government and the banks are so frightened of the property bubble crashing, which it's doing now, because it just was unsustainable. They couldn't keep it going. You know, people can't afford these sorts of properties. It's just crazy. I mean, wages haven't gone up. People are getting into debts that they'll be carrying for, you know,
generations.
There was talk about them having multi-generational loans. That's a great solution for this problem, isn't it? We've been advocating, Bank Reform Now has been advocating to let the house prices fall. They should actually fall about 50% to really try and normalise the situation, because the amount they've risen in the last couple of years has just been crazy. So we'd like a large fall, but obviously there are negative consequences from a large fall like that, because people, will have negative equity situation develop for a lot of people. So the policy we were proposing was that the banks decrease the debt in some fashion related to the market failure. So in other words, the banks have to cop a hit, not just the people that borrowed.
I mean, just, you know, it's funny, actually. When I first left uni, my first job was in the head office of the mortgage department of the lending for the NatWest Bank in the UK. And I had to travel to Birmingham every day. And it was a fascinating job, actually, that sort of came out of left field. It wasn't something I was, you know, it wasn't my big dream to go work in this area. It just came along. And one of the things that really upset me at the time, because I think we went through a mortgage crisis then when I was there, is that they had this giant map up on the wall, and it was a map of the UK. And every time the bank repossessed another home, a little coloured pin went into the wall, and you could not see the British Isles. It was literally covered in multicoloured pins, and a lot of the staff would buy up these homes at sort of discount pricing. Now, the fact that they carried on with people who could only just barely afford these houses, because from where I'm sitting, what's happened now is you've got, well, 800,000 is approximately a million. I'm sure the number is larger than that. Amount of people who, you know, even if one of the people in that relationship lost their job, they could potentially lose their home. So with mandates and everything, we're looking at people losing their jobs, inflation. People had to lose their jobs because kids were being educated at home. So this was all manufactured. And now it feels to me like a pyramid scheme. Is that a wrong description, that they went ahead and lent to these people?
Well, pyramid scheme or Ponzi scheme, that's exactly what it is, though. I mean, this crisis that we're facing now has been deliberately caused by government actions and bank actions, right? Banks have been giving out loans to people who can't afford the loans. That's nothing new. That's been going on for many years, decades, in fact. some people call them liar loans. But basically what happens is terrible. Someone applies, you know this from your previous job, but some people apply for a loan. Now what happens? Some people, you know, claim they've got a higher income and have got more assets than they really do. They want to get a loan, so sometimes they gild the lily and make it look like they can afford it. That's a big mistake.
Yeah.
But equally severe is when a mortgage broker or a bank employee fudges the documents. Right. I mean, that happens. They say
basically, brokers do it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, basically, that what happens is you've got someone who's, you know, working as a kitchen hand somewhere, and then the banker puts down that they're a chef earning, you know, $100,000 a year when they're earning much less than that. I mean, that sort of thing happens. It's terrible. I mean, it's pretty common, not just in Australia, but I mean, this was common in England too. I'm sure you'd know better than me, but you know,
absolutely.
When the fan
We had a saying, Peter, at the bank, and it's funny, this saying was repeated when I worked in automotive as well, that buyers are liars, and that's pretty much what you're talking about. But I think in this situation that's going on with the economy right now, I think this is not for that reason. I think this is because of decisions made by government and banks. I think the thing that annoys me is that they constantly say, if we increase interest rates and if you guys just hang in there with us, if we increase interest rates, we will combat inflation. However, we've had endless interest rate hikes and it seemingly hasn't done anything to inflation. When's this magical, inflation busting bubble going to happen because we're paying so much money? When does that occur?
Well, it's inevitable. It will happen. But there are some complicating issues. So, for example, they'll keep ramping the interest rates up while inflation's a threat. But the thing is, if they ramp it up too far, they'll cause that bubble bursting. That'll cause economic mayhem. Don't forget, when people are spending more money on their mortgages, they're spending less money in the economy. So they're not spending at restaurants. They're not spending at small businesses. So, you know, businesses will fail, unemployment will rise. You get this cascading effect with this. So they push the interest rates up too high and you're going to get significant economic turmoil. So this is the recession. We predicted that it'll actually be more like a depression. So worse than the GFC and approaching what you had in the Great Depression, right? That's the ultimate problem. But the government and the banks are scared of that as well. So what they'll most likely do is they'll push it right to the edge. And then they'll start cutting interest rates before the inflation thing is fully managed. And then they're going to start the boom again. So you get this is how you get this boom bust cycle. I think this time it's going to be pretty serious. And if they make mistakes, if the Reserve Bank makes some mistakes, it could be a huge economic hit, and lots of people are going to be in distress, and lots of people are going to be losing their houses. It's terrible. Just terrible.
Yeah, it's devastating. From everything I've read, it seems like the year 2025 was extremely pivotal for all this. I read about Social Security in the USA literally running out, America becoming bankrupt, and we're certainly seeing that with the exceeding of their debt ceiling recently. It all feels manufactured as an asset draw back to the banks. Do you feel it's manufactured?
Oh yeah, of course. I mean, what's happening? If you really want to get serious, America is in trouble, and the traditional way for them to get out of trouble is to start a war. It's a war economy, basically. You know, even during supposed peacetime, there's always some sort of military war going on, war on terror, war on this, war on this, war on this Middle Eastern country, war on that Middle Eastern country. They always need a war. And so I think when push comes to shove, if the choice for America is going down the tube economically and social chaos, they'll choose war instead. So they'll try and inflate, try and fight their troubles. But don't forget, America, the middle class in America has been screwed for decades. I mean, the disposable income hasn't risen for most Americans for a long time. They're going backwards. The elite are hoovering up as much assets as possible around the world. You know this story just as well as I do. I mean, in America, for example, they're a bit ahead in this mortgage crisis situation. So you've got these big, huge companies like BlackRock and these other investment firms buying up the distressed property. So people can't afford their loans. These big corporations buy them up. And they'll basically rent them out. So basically, many people won't be able to afford a home at all, and they'll be renting for the rest of their lives, which is what they want. The elite, the people who are running the show, want everyone renting everything, right? They want you renting a house. They want you renting a car. They want you renting your music, your books. everything's supposed to be rented now, right?
All on your electrical devices and no cookers and no internal combustion engines. It's certainly not a world for me. And I feel like as well that we've been totally hoodwinked because what is it George Carlin, the comedian, said? They call it the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
What a champ George was.
Yeah, and he said as well, you know, next they're coming for your pensions. They want your Social Security. They want it back. They're going to get it back by hook or by crook. He predicted all this before his death. And it's the same, I feel, with home ownership. It's a big dream to own your own home. But the problem you see is, you know, when you go on and talk about, you know, they have concerns about population increasing and stuff like that. Yeah. When you've got these people who thought, yay, you know, we can buy a 3- and 4-bedroom home. And so they've then gone on and had 3 or 4 kids. So that didn't add to the population by getting them into these mortgages that they couldn't really afford. So I'll talk to you a little bit more about that after the break, Peter. We're just going to take a really quick break here on TNT Radio.
Hey, we're getting back to the news.
TNT Radio News.
What the f***? Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. The giant Chinese balloon that Washington said was spying on key military sites as it drifted across America last week has been shot down over the Atlantic Ocean. Heads continue to roll in Ukraine, with the country's defense minister the latest to be given the boot. And over 20 people have perished and nearly 1,000 more have been injured in wildfires raging across Chile.
On air and on the app.
I listen on the app.
Stay up to date around the clock.
I listen, therefore I know.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Radio. I'm Nicola Charles. Hi, Peter. We were talking before about this false sale of the American dream of home ownership. I agree that all of these big investment firms, Vanguard and BlackRock, I know for a fact that they're actually buying up a lot of properties, particularly around Red Hill and in the Peninsula area in Melbourne. And of course, rents are going through the roof. So we're going to find lots of people lose their homes because they can't afford their mortgage because of the interest rate hike. So they're going to be turfed out. And no doubt, what makes me really sad is that these people will have bad credit. The banks who've created this whole system, they won't have bad credit. They'll be able to do this again, no doubt, in the future when it flip-flops the other way. But these people will have bad credit. They will go into rental accommodation. Then rents will keep climbing and they'll end up finding their rents are potentially even more than the mortgage payments were. And then the interest rates will go back to normal. And if they managed to get through it, they could have kept their home and their repayments would have been lower. This is a total shafting of innocent people. Do you not feel?
It's terrible. It's just terrible. The thing is, basically, you know, one of the fundamental things that lead to peace of mind and quite a lot of degree of happiness in your life is to have your accommodation, your home, under control. Owning your own home is you've got to retire owning your own home. It's a big plus for people, right? And basically, they called it was the Australian dream was to own a home, and lots of people used to be able to do it. But I think if things progress the way they are now, only a very small portion of the population will ever be able to afford to own a home. And that's just not on. It's just not on. And, you know, there are so many issues we can talk about. I mean, let's mention a few other things that cause pressure on the home ownership front. So, for example, you've got some people who have got several homes. Let's say you've got a holiday home. That's okay. Yeah. I don't mind people having a holiday home. That's fine. But what seems to happen is that you've got this shortage of homes, particularly in some regional areas, and the homeowner who's got the holiday home is quite happy to have that holiday home. They might use it several weeks a year, but they obviously if they use it several weeks a year, they can't rent it out permanently to someone. So they'll have it on Airbnb, right? Now, you know, people should be free to do whatever they want with their homes, but if that's on a large scale, there are a large number of houses that are actually empty. So, for example, the other factor is foreign people buying homes, often as an investment, and often it's left vacant. So there are lots of empty Lots of empty houses.
Totally. You see the shutters down. You see those metal, I don't like them, but those metal Australian shutters over the windows. Mm-hmm. And the house is totally shut down. The gardens aren't kept. And you just know that the home isn't being used. And there are just so many homeless people on the streets now.
That's
absolutely devastating. What about this rezoning, Peter? Because councils are also going to do that rezoning thing, whereas if you've got a rural property and you've got a house on, let's say, 5 acres, and you know the government comes along, big daddy government comes along and says, oh, you could have 30 houses on this 5 acres, you know, the size they build them now, and we're rezoning it, and you know, you owe the government $5 million. What do you think about those plans? Because they're very real.
Well, I haven't heard the details about those things. There's all sorts of ways that the government can try and manipulate you. I mean, look, the thing is this, we're manipulated in all sorts of ways, even the way they calculate rates for people. I mean, look at the New South Wales government now. They want to put in a land tax on the family home rather than just get rid of stamp duty. Now, stamp duty is a crap tax. There's no doubt about that.
And it's horrible.
It certainly adds to people's woes trying to save for a house. But
if you
replace that with a land tax, you're paying that every year for the rest of your life. Now, some people say, oh, it's better for a number of reasons. But the thing is, that's a tax. That means you're virtually renting your, even if you own the home, you're still renting it effectively by paying the land tax every year. I mean, you've got to get some reforms which get the government out of your pocket in this way. We've come up with a few different things which would help it. But, you know, I'll mention a couple of things. Now, we've got a sovereign monetary system. It's one of the key reforms to help get the bankers out of your pockets.
That would be good.
Maintaining cash in the economy, that was one of our campaigns we were working on when they tried to,
do that.
well, they're still trying to do that. They want to bring in a central bank digital currency, which is an absolute disaster. Yeah. If that comes about, you might as well close up shop. We've lost the battle. But
I'm paying cash up the yin yang. People are shocked. I just pull out a wad of cash and say, no, I'm buying it with cash because I'm determined to keep cash.
That's right. You've got to do your bit. I mean, we've got a little pamphlet that you can find on our website, the Bank Reform on our website, which you can give to any shop that refuses to take cash. You can give them this pamphlet. We suggest people drop the money on the counter and leave after they get their product rather than muck around. But
tell us about your website, Peter, because people can go there and get all this information.
Oh, it's just bankreformnow.com.au. And we just intermittently put up articles along these lines that we've talked about, articles. Some of this stuff we actually wrote about quite a number of years ago. We could see what the plan was. See, before the general public realizes these things, if you're actually studying the information that's available, you can see that these things have been planned. Central bank digital currency, for example, it's sort of something that's new, seems to have come up new. But if you go back many years, you can find out that the International Monetary Fund was working on this years ago. They pretend that they're not, right? And the government pretended as well that this was not we said this was a worry. We said if you get rid of cash and you have a central bank digital currency, then you're at risk of negative interest rates, so that the banks can take money out of your account. They can also monitor every transaction. They can do bail-in. So if there's a crash, that the banks can just take your deposits.
Take your money out.
Yeah, all those sorts of things we knew were
political
coming.
That's the thing for me. I mean, I'll be broke. They'll take every cent I own in my digidollars because, you know, I disagree with everything they say politically and I say it publicly and they'll say, you've been fined that, you know, the thought tax and you're broke.
funny thing is the government is putting these sorts of policies in place or letting it happen and there's no real discussion. No
referendum.
No discussion before the election. Both sides of the politics are just as bad.
Yes, I agree.
Pretty much. Mm. So, you know, they didn't go to the election saying we're gonna put in place a central bank digital currency. You'll have no privacy. We'll monitor everything that you track. We'll put in place some sort of carbon credit system so you won't be able to buy more than so many litres of petrol or you won't be able to eat so many kilos of meat per week. Yes. I mean, these are the sorts of things people are worried about. I mean, it sounds outlandish, but when you see how they're attacking the farmers in the Netherlands, for example, shutting down meat production, and then you see the World Economic Forum talk about people eating bugs and crickets and this stuff to get you off the meat. I mean, what sort of world are we heading towards?
Yeah, it's terrible shade. I know. You just honestly, come on here and rant because I feel the same way. It's terrible shade. You know, every time I see a post by Dan Andrews and he's grinning because he's at a gay pride march or he's grinning because he's fixed a railway crossing and people don't realize that he's fixing all the inner city railway crossings because he wants you all trapped in that smart city. So yes, he's going to make it easier for you to move around cities and then you'll find there's a checkpoint and you can't go into the countryside and it will be some rubbish excuse of, you know, your carbon usage and saving the planet. And obviously it's just the loss of all our freedoms. I think it's absolutely disgusting. I can't believe Australians are putting up with it, Peter. Why do you think they are not kicking up more of a fuss about all this?
I think they will eventually. I think eventually it's going to dawn on them what's happening. I think part of it is that the mainstream media doesn't really explain what's really happening. But you go to England. I mean, you've probably got friends and relatives in England. Look, for sure. Yeah. Apparently this 15 or 20 minute
Oxford, yeah.
Oxford City things have already come in a couple of places there. You know, there is potential for some significant restrictions on people, and it's hard to believe the British are copping it as well. Don't the people in Oxford complain about this? What's the feeling?
I actually had a Catholic priest on, a lovely young guy, and he's actually from Manchester, and he was formerly a police officer in Oxford. And he said when he was both on duty and off duty, these police officers also display civil disobedience and just drive over or through these bollards. And of course, all these cameras are picking up people exercising their civil disobedience. I guess you can call it peacefully. There were no human beings involved, but a little bit of vandalism of a bollard. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that for a few minutes when we get back, Peter. I'm just going to go to a really quick break. You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Bye-bye, Baron!
Or Pop Goes the Weasel.
After an embarrassing 5 days in which the feckless Biden administration allowed a Chinese spy balloon to transit the continental United States, an F-22 today was ordered to take the balloon down with a Sidewinder missile to the payload over the ocean so that no forensically useful wreckage could be recovered. Sounds like the big guy is taking his orders from an even bigger guy. Well, 10% to the big guy definitely came with strings attached, didn't it? And here they all come now. Oh, there were 3 balloons under the Trump administration, and there was a balloon under the Biden administration a couple years ago. It's not a big deal. Well, we're thinking it is a big deal, and we're thinking Republicans in Congress had better look into it. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Many power grids worldwide are in grave danger of collapse from the growing amount of intermittent power sourced from wind turbines. Covering the countryside and offshore coastal regions with wind turbines is insane. English journalist James Dellingpole has described wind farms as a cancer and that he wants to raise public awareness of just how disastrous these bat-chomping, bird-slicing eco-crucifixes are in every single respect. These remarks nail the reality of wind farms to a T. When the wind doesn't blow, there is no power. And when gale force winds hit, the turbines are shut down. It's a Goldilocks moment. When the winds are just right, the power produced is at an optimum. In reality, industry and households require power 24/7, not just when the wind blows.
Here's what I wanted to add to that conversation.
The conversation continues.
They just mean well, but they can't do any better what they're doing.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I'm Nicola Charles. This is TNT Radio. I was going to speak to Peter Moore, but I will speak to him more another day. We're actually going to have a talk now with Warren Mundine, who has an Order of the Australian Empire. Warren is an Australian Aboriginal leader and politician, and he was the national president of the Australian Labor Party, but quit the party in 2012. He was appointed chairman of the Coalition Government's Indigenous Advisory Council by then Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Warren is a leading opponent of the Voice to Parliament campaign. Welcome to the show, Warren. It's lovely to meet you.
It's lovely to meet you too, Nicola.
Warren, I'm really, really interesting that you're opposing the Voice to Parliament. I think I do as well. I haven't said much about my own opinions on it. Why do you oppose it?
Well, for several reasons, you know, it's built on a falsehood that there's no voice to the Aboriginals have, and Torres Strait Islanders have no voice to Parliament, and in fact, there's over 100 committees and councils that have been set up to advise ministers and government people, as well as the crossbenchers, the opposition, about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues. And they do, and since 1973, they've had four attempts at an advisory council to the Parliament and to government, and they have all failed. And so I don't know what this voice is going to make any difference to. And at the same time, you know, we look at what happens in Alice Springs, and the champions of this voice, the Parliament, can't explain how that's going to make a difference to that.
Right. I heard that the this referendum, because it always sounds good when governments use the term referendum, because you think, oh, great, I have a choice. But I saw an interview with a lawyer, and she said that the referendum is only about the language being used in this paperwork, and that actually at the end of the day, all the decisions are just made by everyone in Parliament, and Aboriginals won't get a voice anyway. Is that how you see it?
Well, that's how I see it, because it is an advisory group. So they can advise, and this is the rhetoric from the campaign that's for yes to support the referendum, and it says only advise, the government or the Parliament can reject their advice and do whatever they like. So you sort of sit there and go, well, what's the point of it?
Yeah. Yes, it seems like more virtue signalling to me. And, you know, an awful lot of people get paid to go on these advisory committees and on these boards and these councils. And, you know, they do lots of photo opportunities. But from where I'm sitting, you know, if you look at the situation in Alice Springs, what is the Australian government doing about this? Some of the measures that they were suggesting I found so draconian and really quite offensive. And I'm not someone that gets offended at all. I'm a conservative. But they were talking about taking some of the children from the parents in Alice Springs. How do you feel about that issue?
Well, this is the madness of it all. The alcohol problems and the kids in the streets are a result of underlying issues. And the underlying issues, and I've sat as co-chair of the review of sexual abuse of Aboriginal children in New South Wales, and I sat on the review of adult prisons and reoffending in South Australia. And I could, the sexual abuse of children leads to crimes, and you're seeing those results with incarceration rates. And also, you know, getting cases such as 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, and that being raped by adults and children as young as 14 and 12. And you start to, this is the breakdown of social issues. So yes, you can come in and ban the alcohol. Yes, you can, you need to get more tougher policing in it, but then you've got to deal with the underlying issues about how do we work with parents and how do we work with kids to make sure that these communities are safe, that parental control is back in charge, that that people learn how to bring up their kids and be good parents, and that we get kids educated, we get investments in Aboriginal communities, and we get businesses and jobs going. And these are the things that we know from a couple of hundred years of history that really make a difference to these type of issues.
Yeah. I get really annoyed when, and of course this happens in just so many different communities globally, all over the world, when there is tension in a community and, you know, violence erupts and this kind of thing happens, government steps in and tends to see it as an opportunity to use those events to get something out of it for itself. And when they were talking about removing the children, I was just horrified because I'd read about the Stolen Generations, and I I thought, oh my God, here we go again. I mean, really and truly, like any community that's in crisis, isn't the problem in Alice Springs? Isn't it? Doesn't it boil down? Yeah, I know it's education, but doesn't it boil down to economic pressure, right? If there were jobs and a better functioning community, we can send billions and billions of taxpayer dollars to Ukraine, but we can't build up the precious community of Alice Springs.
Look, you're 100%, Nicola, 100% right in regard to that. You've got to deal with these social issues. You've got to deal with these parental issues. And you've got to have economic development where jobs, and so kids can see the relevance of going to school, getting a skill and an education so they can get a job. And those things make tremendous changes for the community. And you're also right in regard to government. I don't know any government in the history of humans that actually can bring up a child better than a parent. We need to train and work with parents and that, because our young kids, you know, they're 16, they're 14, and they're getting, and girls are getting pregnant, and boys are impregnating them, of course, and then you're getting all these social problems. We need to support those kids. We need to show them how to build morals and ethic into their children, how they look after them and feed them and get a roof over their head. And the only way you can do those is through economic development to happen, so they can get jobs and pay for all this stuff and work for it all. It's a vicious cycle that's been going on for decades. And governments are getting no better than that. Look, you had the Prime Minister go to Alice Springs. He spent 5 hours there. The flight going there was longer than how many hours he spent.
Yeah, nice
there.
Photo. Then he went,
photo op. Then he went to the tennis, you know, for 3 days, sitting in a corporate box, drinking alcohol and laughing and carrying on, getting photos taken of him at that tennis. That 3 days, in fact, one of the tennis matches lasted longer than his stay in Alice Springs. You know, and now we have the Territory government, Northern Territory government, the laws that they stopped and took out because they said they were bad, and now they're putting them back in. This is just the vicious cycle. We need to go beyond just the alcohol bans and the policing. Yes, that needs to calm the situation down. And then we need to work with those families and with those groups about in jobs and employment and parental control.
So you're actually in favour of an alcohol ban?
Well, I am for a short period of time. But it's got to be non-discriminatory. So anyone in that region's got to be, you know, and we've got to be able to put in a police presence that will last only a couple of months, that'll calm things down, and then we've got to get business involved, we've got to get the community involved to take leadership about fixing things. And this idea that governments can do a better job than parents and families is a nonsense, and we know that from historical data.
Yeah, and it's the same in any community, in any country in the world. I believe in small government, and when these big governments come along, it's an absolute disaster.
Correct.
Now, they talk a lot about reparations and equity, don't they? Everything I can see going on in the world at the moment is about as far from equity as it's possible to get. What they sort of sold this to us as, whether it's nationally or globally and the World Economic Forum, is, it seemed to feel like they were going to raise up the world to live at the level of the Western nations. And instead, what they're doing is taking down the Western nations to live at the level and stress and poverty of the poorer nations, which I find absolutely staggering. I just really am amazed that they send so much money overseas and they don't take care of the issues here. Now, I read that, and I'll check this with you, I read that you have 10 children. Is that sort of common to have that many children within these communities?
It is, but my 10 children, I made sure that they were given morals and giving ethics, such as work, the work ethic, how you treat other people, how you are disciplined to make sure that you're respectful to your parents and to your aunties and uncles and grandparents and your neighbours. You don't go over next door and kick their garbage bin over. No, you treat them with respect, and then they learn that by me going to work, they see me going to work every day. and they learn, okay, this is what we do. We get up at 5 a.m., we get dressed and cleaned and that, and we go to school. And then we go from there after school, we go to work. And that's what they did. In fact, a lot of my kids used to work after school in the local corner store paper boys or paper girls, and that, and they used to do. And then they worked at McDonald's as they got older. And then they worked at a whole wide range of other jobs as they did their education. And look at them. Three of my sons run their own businesses now.
Fantastic.
My daughters went to university and have built careers for themselves, and this is what you do. So
I have lots of kids too. I asked you, Warren, but honestly, I have lots of children too, and I don't see a problem with. They didn't tell us there was a problem with having lots of children until this year.
Oh yeah, I know. The issue is not about how many children or no children. The issue is about how do you know, people come to me their child's 13 and they say, oh, they're wild and they're going crazy. What can I do? And I said, well, it's a bit late. You should have done that from birth. As soon as you brought that child home from hospital, you should have been installing in that child the work ethic, the morals and the reading and the writing and making sure if you make rubbish, you clean it up, you make your bed in the morning, you help wash and wipe up after dinner, you learn how to cook, you learn how to sew, and you mow the lawns and all this type of stuff. You've got to teach kids from day one.
It's
no good
great.
Waking up at 14 and saying, oh, let's do it now. It's too late.
Yeah. No, it's too late, because then society and governments have got hold of them, because the way I feel we're going at the moment is governments seem to be on this really strong path of almost demotivating the young generations. You know, there's all this talk about universal basic income, that they're doing all kinds of strange things, including gun laws and all kinds of things. And they say, oh, well, you know, this will help us pay people an extra $80 a week on the dole. I would have thought it would have been better to sort of encourage children that, you know, a hard day's work gets a hard day's pay. But we seem to be in a situation now, and perhaps you would like to tell me why you left the Labour Party. Are these very left-leaning policies? Is this part of why you left?
Yeah, well, I was in the right wing of the Labour Party, a conservative, and I was a strong supporter of the Hawke Keating reforms about how we dealt with unions, how do we got productivity up, how do we support business, get rid of regulations, not all regulations, but, you know, stop putting the burden on small businesses who employ most people in Australia, and helping them run a business and produce good products and all that type of stuff. So I was a very strong supporter of that. And look, it's... you know, it's one of the big worries I have. Look, is that Australians, we're generous. If someone falls on hard times, we're happy to help them. But part of that happiness to help them is to make sure they're safe, they've got a roof over their head and that. But it's also to get them back to work. We have intergenerational families that have never had work for 2, 3, 4 generations. Now, how are you supposed to teach a kid about work when you're sitting, you know, I'm sitting on the lounge, you know, having a beer, watching TV, I know you don't know this stuff, Nicola, you know, like having a bong and stuff like that, and then you're telling the kid to go to work. Well, the kids looking at you and they go,
demotivated.
Wait a minute, and government has never ever. I've been able to bring up a kid, and they've never ever been able to resolve these issues. It's about how government, you know, we're happy to do the welfare stuff, but it's within 12 months you've got to get back to work.
Yeah, I always think, Warren, that it would be great, you know, in all areas of the country, if there was some sort of apprenticeship that was required just for young people to qualify for the dole. I understand when people are older and they've worked for a company for a long time, and probably that company is facing a lot of red tape and stuff now because of, you know, climate targets and all that kind of stuff. I understand adults losing their jobs and needing assistance. You know, we all get to that point in our life. It's happened to me as well. But for young people, I feel that, you know, clocking onto 18 and simply getting, you know, the dole and social assistance, I feel like, oh, well, yeah, you'll absolutely, you'll get that. But pick a trade because you're also going to be an apprentice for somebody. And it wouldn't take much for governments to set that up where they could go and work in a flower shop or a supermarket or with a tradie. And what that would do then, I feel, is it would get them excited about something. And sure, you know, you might not be getting a great amount of money at the end of it, but you might look at the people that you're apprenticing for and you might say, gee, look at him, you know, he's a plumber, he has his own business, he's bought a farm, I want to do that, just to inspire these kids. Because as you say, if you're coming from generations of unemployment and people that don't have jobs, let alone careers, what hope is there for these young people?
That is correct. And you've got to intervene in that process. Look, years ago, even companies like BHP in the 50s and 60s and that, before you went to university to do engineering, you actually did a trade. And so the management and all the people on the board and the managing director all had trades, all knew what it was like to work hard on the floor as well as, you know, managing the business. You know, we see that in some German companies and that as well. It is, my boys, when they were in year 10, 11 and 12 at school, they actually did part of their trade at that school. And
yeah,
so they were able to pick and choose what trade they were going to do and then complete their trade post high school and
Wonderful.
Then go on and run their own businesses. Now, these are the things that we've got. And we've got to show kids that everything is possible.
Just got a few seconds to go, Warren. Sorry, so sorry to cut you off. You're an absolutely fantastic guest. I'd love to have you back on the show. And it sounds like you're a really caring, proactive parent. Thanks so much for chatting. I'll see you next time. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to TNT Radio.